Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Support Rabble. Go to rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio, free radio.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Today we're bringing you an excerpt from a panel of speakers recorded at the World Social Forum in Montreal in early August. It was called Indigenous People's Struggles and Resistance, Building Solidarity for Land, Self-Determination, and Justice. What you'll hear is a variety of perspectives on one common theme: the need to protect Mother Earth from the ravages of corporate greed and environmental devastation, and the right of Indigenous people to control their lands, their territories, and their way of life. You'll hear Tom Goldtooth, who's a Native American environmental, climate, and economic justice activist. He's also a speaker, a film producer, and an Indigenous rights leader. He's from Minnesota. And Joseph Wawadi is a traditional Algonquin from Barrier Lake in western Quebec. In 2012, he was arrested for protesting logging on his traditional territory, land which remains unceded. He speaks of his traditional life in the bush and the challenges his nation faces. Sitting next to him was his brother, Jacob Wawadi. He's an Algonquin elder and Native Studies educator at the University of Ottawa. He's also founder of Coconville Academy, an organization which seeks to integrate Indigenous and settler approaches towards nature, development, and overall ways of life. And last, we'll hear from Romeo Saganash, MP and NDP critic for Intergovernmental Indigenous Affairs. He's tabled a private member's bill, Bill C-262, to ensure that the laws of Canada respect the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
My name is Tom Goldtooth, and I'm with the Indigenous Environmental Network, and we're not just an NGO, a non-governmental organization. We are founded with the spiritual foundation coming from traditional societies from what we call Turtle Island. And yes, you know, we do not represent the elected tribal leaders of the electoral governments that were imposed upon us on the state side. Many of our leadership come from a long lineage of traditional societies. So we still have those traditional leaders within many of our tribal communities, our tribal nations. And most of our foundation is on the state side, our United States. Some of our founders also come from what is known as Canada. In our long history of organizing since 1990, that's when we were formed, we felt that in our critical analysis that we need to do something different, that a lot of the corporations, someone mentioned the role of the corporations, but also is the role of the colonial government as well, that allows the corporations to have the power that they have. It is a revolving door between corporations and government and NGOs. From my experience in participating in the United Nations, for an example, one of our mandates as Indigenous peoples coming together around the environment, which is defending the sacredness of our Mother Earth and Father Sky. Those two entities, Father Sky and Mother Earth, is part of the creation, the natural laws of the universe. And one of the mandates of that is to come together as a confederation, as an alliance, as a collective of Indigenous peoples, a voice of the youth and the elders. That's how we were formed. Milton Bourne with the Tooth is one of the founders from Alberta, from the Blood Nation. I think he took a bulldozer to Old Man Dam. It was a dam issue back then. But part of the energy policy has been to flood indigenous people's lands. As many of you know, our brother from James Bay region, very often know our Fort Berthold people from North Dakota. It's always been this colonized mentality, kind of like a predator type of way of life that people brought with them from Europe. Somehow back in those early years of settlers coming to this, our part of the world, there was something about them that they somehow lost their connection to what we say is the sacredness to our Mother Earth. They didn't have that understanding. Some did. Some of the farmers in North Dakota and Minnesota, where I'm from, I'm Dakota, but they were Kantawan Dakota, the dwellers of the Sacred Lake. My mother is Southern Dene. I've been up to Northern Dene country of the Athabascan Chippewa First Nation, where Tar Sands is. That's our northern relative. So I'm Dene and Dakota. So we have farmers who are descendants. Some of them carry some old tribal earth ways with them that they understood, but basically many had lost those old teachings of how to relate to Mother Earth. So years later, here we are as indigenous peoples trying to fight off the encroachment not only of colonization and the governmental structures that have never fully recognized our rights as indigenous peoples, have never fully recognized our self-determination to make our own decisions, our own sovereignty, to be able to recognize that we have jurisprudence over our territories. But does Canada recognize it? Never. Does United States recognize that? Never. So in the United States, land has always been the issue from the beginning, land, and who controls the land. That has been always the fundamental conflict that we have faced with colonizers coming, landing on the eastern shores. We have to look at the doctrines that were utilized in this colonization of our territories, and you may read about this called Doctrines of Discovery, how the governments of Europe and the church needed to work together. They needed to somehow legally, under international law, occupy a territory that was already occupied, and with civilizations, with people that had song, that had spirituality, we had language. But somehow they had to create a tool, a doctrine of discovery, you could call it the papal bull, in a way that they redefine who we are as less than human, that we were pagans. We were just these people that were uncivilized, running around naked in the land, that we're just, you know, lazy and we weren't using all the land. So they reclassified us as a tool of discovery. And that's why we have a movement of resistance to change these policies that have been integrated now in colonial law, Canada and United States. And I know that our presentation is very brief and we want to keep it open for dialogue, but I needed to start out with this principle, not a principle, really it's been implemented. We had indigenous people who have actually had an opportunity to finally meet with the Pope and the Pope's captains and the colonels, and they said, we're going to study this argument. They said, we already pulled back on the papal bull. We already pulled back, and we're not implementing those doctrines of discovery anymore. But we had to say, but Canada has implemented, now it's a foundation of the indigenous, of Indian rights, not in rights, but Indian law in the United States. That's factual. So we said we have to change that. My other comment about indigenous resistance is our network. We were formed in 1990 when a lot of the waste companies, toxic waste companies, and also the nuclear energy, and they were looking for a place to store toxic and radioactive waste. This was going on in Canada, but not as large a degree it was happening in the United States. Where were they going to store this? They were trying to come to our territories, thinking that we're dumb, thinking that we're broke and we're living in poverty. So they're making these big, we call it nowadays benefit sharing. Have to be very cautious on these concepts of benefit sharing, because they said, we have monetary and financial benefits we can give you if you can store our nuclear waste in your land. Trust us, we have modern technologies. Don't worry about it. We have engineers, we have scientists, we can store it under the ground. Don't believe Tom Goldtooth and all these indigenous activists who say it's going to leak, it's going to contaminate the earth. So we're confronted with this mentality. White is right. One of the symptoms of colonization that I've studied throughout the world, Australia, the Adivasis from India, the Khoisan from South Africa, is the symptom of internalized oppression. Internalized oppression, to where we have internalized the way of the oppressor. So sometimes it's challenging to confront these contradictions of governance that's being promoted by Canada and United States, saying that they are heroes of human rights. They're saying that they are reducing their carbon footprint under this new minister, Trudeau. But we see business as usual. That's what we see. Are they going to cut back the production of greenhouse gases and other toxic releases in the tar sands? No. If you look at the figures, they're not cutting back. They're even still promoting the pipeline, the transportation infrastructure. So we see the contradictions, but they play numbers with us the same way they played numbers in the early years of colonization. So indigenous resistance, we had to organize ourselves as indigenous peoples, taking a lead from the youth, taking the lead from our elders. That's how our network was formed. And since 1990s, when we organized, we have effectively stopped a lot of toxic waste proposals that have come into our territories. We have stopped Yucca Mountain in Nevada. And generally, we're hesitant of working in the system, okay? And we've been organizing since then in what some of you call direct action. We organize on the front line. Whether it's the pipeline resistors that you read about in social networking, those are all out croppings of our organizing approach, given the ability of our communities to speak for themselves. Very important, because it's been so long that the government has spoke for us. And so the other area that I want to briefly talk about in this struggles and resistance and building solidarity is that we don't have the political power in the United States, as well as in Canada. The political power, who has the political power for change? So in the United States, we've been systematically organizing with our, first of all, we were part of what we call the environmental justice movement in the early 1990s, to where we saw that the colonial environmental and public health laws of the United States was racist, that there was disproportionate dumping and releasing of toxic chemicals and pollution in people of color, lands, and neighborhoods and communities. White communities, even though there's some contamination, did not suffer as much as people of color. Racism reared its ugly head in the United States. It's still a big issue. Woven into looking at environmental issues and public health issues from a social justice perspective, applying an environmental justice framework of racism was very critical to us because that was woven into racism as well. American Indian tribes and Alaska Natives, all these extractive energy companies and extractive companies, even deforestation, mining companies, toxic waste facilities, all coming to Indian country with no environmental infrastructure to even protect our territories. Our chief and council, our tribal leadership and council, had no environmental program. We had no one to advise our tribal leaders. It was the corporations who said, trust us, we have ecologists even. We have environmental specialists. We have engineers. Don't worry about Tom Goldtooth and these radical left thinkers, you know. Trust us, we have the technology. We can form partnerships. That was happening in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s in the United States. Partnerships, trilateral agreements, accommodation agreements between the provincial government or the state government, the federal government, the corporation, and our leadership. And we said, no, we're not going to do that. The grassroots voice of indigenous people, that's who we are, the grassroots voice. And we strengthen our tribal leadership. We are protective of sovereignty, but we want to hold our own elected tribal leadership accountable as well, just like what the I Don't Know More is doing here in Canada with the Assembly of First Nations, these organizations into tribal voices, the tribal leaders. We have the same thing in the United States called the National Congress of American Indians. Some of them are my own relatives that have come and gone on those. So we, as our resistance and our strategies and building solidarity is internally in our communities, confronting internalized oppression and lifting up our importance of our culture, our language, our spirituality as a foundation of that resistance. The solidarity with the settlers is very important. We are part of also the Global Alliance of Rights of Nature. That's something that our network and me personally have been looking at, because we have prophecies from some tribes, indigenous nations, that talk about the settlers coming full circle to finally understanding what we mean when we talk about the sacredness of the female creative principle of Mother Earth. When we talk about Father Sky, we talk about the spirituality. Or in the homeland of my brother Minari, that sacred woman of the forests. We understand what that is as indigenous peoples, but majority of the people of the world do not. They have been systematically, through industrialization, removed from Mother Earth, promoting individuality, promoting policies and technologies that have no understanding of the sacredness of Mother Earth. So this is woven into something that's very principled to us that comes from the Haudenosaunee, the Mohawk, the Senecas, the seven council fires. It's the seventh generation principle. Other nations have that understanding as well. Whatever decisions that we make in the current moment, we got to consider the impact of that decision on our future generations. In United Nations policy making, they call something called precautionary principle. The precautionary principle. We understand that. But we have governments like Canada, United States, with corporations fighting the implementation of policies that recognize the precautionary principle. And so that's where we have leadership, corporate and government, that don't recognize these very fundamental principles that define our relationship with Mother Earth. That's why we are part of this movement to wake up the world as part of systems change, not climate change. We have to change a system in the way that it has, in a way that it does not understand its relationship to Mother Earth and the sacredness of Mother Earth. So with that said, just one more minute. Most of the colonial laws that comes out of the United States, it's worldwide now. I used to always give heck to the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Okay, they go worldwide. They have an international affairs office. So I see them in Africa. I see a representative of U.S. EPA in Africa. I even see them in the Philippines. They're advising not how to prevent pollution, how to manage pollution, managing the unmanageable. But why I mention this is that we're dealing with colonial laws based upon property rights. Property rights. So why is it my brothers from the Dene, Northern Dene, or the Cree, Miccosu Cree, or the Métis at Fort Chip, why is it that they have to try to raise money just to have legal standing? Legal standing to have a voice, whether it's a voice that challenges consultation, or legal standing just to question and challenge the environmental laws of Canada or the laws of the protection of the water. In the United States, we as sovereign tribal nations, we have to fight for legal standing all the time. There's a contradiction here because Shell, Syncor, Exxon, Total from France, Norway, Statoil, they have more legal standing than our own indigenous peoples do. Norway even is a major investor in the false solutions of carbon trading and carbon market in South America, in Africa, that allows the polluters to continue to pollute and don't cut emissions at source. That's why we're calling out a lot of the things that came out of Paris Agreement just a couple months ago at the UN climate meeting as false solutions, carbon trading, carbon market. You cannot trade air carbon. You cannot trade methane, the trees, the plants that absorb and breathe carbon, without determining whose property right that is. At the end of the day, whose property right that is that? It's not going to be the indigenous peoples. Even though we choose to participate in this evil scheme, how do we reconcile that with our future generation and with the spirit of the forest? To participate in a system that privatizes the trees, that privatizes the air. What do we have to give of our soul, of our spirit, to participate in a corrupt system? That's why I'm saying part of our resistance is going deeper. It's going deeper to where none of you, human beings, will have any rights. Any rights. You will probably be saying, I understand these indigenous people when they say they've been fighting for their rights, their inherent rights, because my rights are being taken away too. In the United States, the pipeline, the government comes in and says to the private landowner, you have no rights because this is part of our energy plan of the United States. So they're taking away the rights of the private landowners in order for the pipeline regime, the big black snake, the monster to go through. That's what we're fighting deep right now. It's a taking of Mother Earth, the rights of Mother Earth, the nature of the life itself is being owned. Owned by who? That's the question. And that's why our resistance is going deeper in our critical analysis. Yes, we're going to still fight for our self-determination. We're going to still fight for our rights as indigenous people and fight for the implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People here in Canada, United States, and Ecuador. But at the same time, the World Bank, the financial institutions, the corporations, the governments of the North, they're all participating in this manipulation of the sacred. There's another session about financialization of biodiversity, of everything. There even you can, if you're a corporate man here and you want to destroy a wetland here, you can go ahead and destroy this wetland as long as you use your money to restore another wetland way over here. You then offset the damage here by restoring another wetland over here, but does that make it good? Carbon offsets in the north. They're buying trees, protecting trees in the homeland in Ecuador, social bosque. They have these tree, private tree parks, but the people can't go and take the trees anymore to build their homes. They even have police force protecting these trees. So these regimes we got to look at. So that's why part of my statement on struggles, resistance, building solidarity is that we need the non-indigenous peoples of the world to wake up, to understand what's going on. It's deeper, it's deep right now. And it does require systems change. Thank you very much.
Next, we'll hear from Joseph Wawati.
I was born in the States, so I lived there for a little while, and I came back up here with my parents, and I went to boarding homes. I went to boarding school for 6 years. I stay away from my mom for at least a good 10 months per year, or 9 months per year. And it stayed like that until I was about 22 when I was going to school. I went to university in Chicoutimi. Most of my life was actually living in the bush, learning how to live, learning how to hunt, how to trap, how to fish, and everything that I hate was actually from the bush. I hardly hate anything that was from unnatural world, which is the city. But I got used to eating that, so I went into McDonald's like everybody else, and went on so far. After a while, but one of them that started in 1987. Where the forestry company started to cut near where we used to live. Our band council decided to negotiate with the forestry companies. So it went up to 1991 where they made a trilateral agreement, where the Quebec, Canada, and the band council came together as one to make a study. And the study was about how much land do we use, how much water do we use, what do we do with it. Band council turned that around and made it a business out of it with the forestry companies, because the forestry companies, they knew that how much money they were taking woods out of the bush. For the last maybe 21 years now, our band councils have negotiated with the forestry companies every year. We have stopped, we have made protests, Some of us went to jail. I went to jail. I was caught for mischief only. That was about not too long ago, in 2012, I think, something like that, where we did the last protest against the forestry companies. It was actually in my father's territory, and we tried to defend it as much as we can. But actually with no success, because somebody made an agreement already to let the companies cut, which it was the bank council. For the last 21 years that I've seen the Parc La Vérendrye being cut, there's at least about 85% of the wildlife reserve that's been cut in where we live. There's hardly any animals. There's hardly no moose. There's a lot of deers that are coming in because of the clear cuts. And when they do a clear cut, they only put one species, a tree. So therefore, the animals cannot eat. So they move. They go somewhere else. As soon as some of the trees they grow, they brush cut again. And they just leave that one tree there. Long, long time ago, before they did that, they used to cut, yeah, but they used to leave trees there and they just let the forest grow back on its own. It's not like that anymore. They dig up the dirt, they turn it around, they put trees there, and they just leave it like that. There's a lot of wood out there that's not been used. And the forestry companies left it there. You cannot imagine how it looks like. Because if you would see the images of what they've done to our land, to our territory, to our way of life, they're destroying completely our way of life. And yet they want us to live in the city or on a reserve. But we're not like that. We're not made like that. We're made to be living in the bush, not in the city. So eventually we adapt. We adapt to living where we live today. I adapt to open the water with just a twist of my hand. I could flick a light, just that's how easy it is. You got to warm up your house. You just turn the temperature now. That's how easy it is. So anyways, I'm not going to talk too much. My heart is filled with grief for all the things that's happening. You know what the government is doing to us. I'm not talking about only the government in Canada. I'm talking also about the government of Quebec. Those are only cooperations. Those are corporate. It's an organization. An organization that gives other organizations. Like, I'm not sure anybody who has an organization, but they do have one. And guess where you get it? You get it from Canada or Quebec, one of the two. The one that lives here. You have to follow their laws, because they wrote it down for you. If you don't follow those laws, they'll arrest you, they'll take your organization away, and they'll cut it off from you. They have the right to do that, because they make it to have that right. If you stop them, they will arrest you. They'll throw you to jail, like the way they did to us. So my life in the woods has been destroyed slowly. I have a hard time to hunt. Today, I've been so sick, me too, myself. Went to dialysis, I got a new kidney, I'm diabetic. There's a lot of stuff that's going on here. And this is the way we are. A doctor came over and he says, you know, you're diabetic. I said, I didn't know that. Oh, it's genetic. I told you, you're full of shit. Sorry about the language. But that's the way I told him. It is not genetic. It's the way you feed us. Our system is not the same as yours. Even today, I still look around for what I'm looking for. Most of it is healing. Not a healing for me. Healing for the nation. Healing for your nation.
My name is Jacob Awadi, and I have been a teacher since 1971. I started with the elementary school. And now I'm working at the University of Ottawa, you know, on Native Studies, developing a curriculum to understand what is nature, what is the culture, and so on. So it starts off around at the same time what he was talking about in 1991. Where the band council had agreed that our territory should be cut. But this thing, the negotiation was done with the band council, you know, the chief of the reservation. And the people of the land wasn't represented through that. Their rights weren't protected through the trilateral agreement. So what we did was we did some blockades and we got arrested. And this is where I began to create a curriculum in order to develop, you know, an idea, you know, of how to survive in nature. You know, it was a small school which I called Cookinville Academy. And the idea of the Cookinville Academy is to create a vision, a sustainable way of existing with nature. So in 2001, I created the first workshop. And the first workshop was to find out the knowledge of the people. What did they know about nature? Like if I had to ask today, yeah, what do you know about nature? Yeah. So the knowledge of nature is very minimal. Yeah. As individuals, you might know one or two things about nature. In a collective setting, you might survive. But as individual, all of you would die. So I did this with what they call the Rainbow People. And I had like about 2,000 participants within the month, you know, in the territory. So this is where I seen the people, how much knowledge they had. So in 2003, I created another workshop where we were showing them, our family created a workshop where we acknowledged the gift of the water, you know, the ducks, the fish, beaver, you know, the plants that grows in the water. And then we sent another one of my brothers in a swamp, see what kind of gift they had in the swamp, the cranberries, the Labrador tea, and the animals that are utilizing that territory, that environment. And then I sent another one to the mountains where we do our sugar, where we pick up our, fiddleheads and mushrooms and what have you up on the hills. And then I sent another one in a clear cut. What happens to our culture? We showed them how to cut up the animals, how to prepare recipes with different creatures that we got from the land. This was to create a vision of how our people live off the land. You see, what you feel in this town, you have your food at your disposal. You have your medicine at your disposal. You got your clothing, your shelter, and what have you that you need to survive. We have all of that in the forest. We're happy to go get that. We are happy to live amongst all those gifts that the Creator has given us. And then in 2007, I created another workshop, which is to acknowledge the plants, where they grow, how do we process them to create medicine, and so on. You see, like, when we talk about economy only means resources. That's what's on the land. That's the resources. If I kill a moose, I get my resource. And when I put it in my freezer, it becomes my capital. Now my capital is being disposed of as if I didn't exist in the forest. The medicine are being crushed. Nature is being changed. The animals are moving. And this is what's happening on the land. And this is the reason why I created Cookinville Academy. It is to show the world how do we exist prior to the arrival of the Europeans, before colonization. We did exist. We had our belief that the Creator gave us all of that. When we look at paradise, try to understand what paradise is. When I look at the society, the paradise that the human is looking for today is simplicity. So they don't have to run for their food, they don't have to hunt for their medicine, they don't have to, you know, produce, you know, learn chemistry. We understood biology. We understood chemistry, that's why we were mixing plants. We understood astronomy, that's why we got names for the stars. We understood the land, that's why we understood geology, geography. That's how connected we were to the land. But our spirit were never recognized as human beings, as part of the human society of the world of Mother Earth. You see, like the way I understood the teaching of Mother Earth is that Mother Earth is like a home. When you give a house to a woman, a girl, she'll decorate it, she'll have flowers and knickknacks and all those delicate stuff. But when you give it to a mother, then the house changes. There's medicine in there. There's clothes, there's food, there's security. Because that's the mother. And the grandmother puts the rules. And that's the way I understood the woman. And the earth is the same way. Mother Earth has put medicine, has put food, has put shelter, has put everything that we needed. That's how Mother Nature is understood in our society. Father-son produces the energy necessary for Mother Earth to acquire the goods that we need to survive with. And that's the intent of Cookinville Academy. So that's how long I'm going to make my speech today. Yeah. Might have another one later on where I could talk some more about it. Yeah. So anyway, thank you very much for listening.
I just want to, before I start though, I just want to briefly explain who I am, where I'm from. My name is Romeo Saganash. I'm from Northern Quebec, a small community called Waswanipi. Waswanipi in Cree means light on the water. My people used to hunt or spear sturgeon at night. And other peoples that came to our territory noticed that we speared sturgeon at night with torches. And that's how the name came about, light on the water. That's where Waswanipi comes from. So I'm part of the last generation of Crees that were born in the forest, raised in the forest. So I lived the first 7.5 years of my life in a forest, hunting, fishing, and trapping with my parents and my siblings. And so I did that for the first 7 years of my life. In fact, the only language that I spoke and that I've heard during those first 7 years of my life was my own language, Cree. Then I was taken away for 10 years into this system called residential schools in this country, where kids were forcibly taken away from their families and communities and put into these residential, what they call residential schools in this country. So I spent the next 10 years in residential school. And I still recall, because when I arrived at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and that day they took us away. We arrived late, 2 or 3 in the morning, and I saw the priest up the stairs talking to us. I didn't understand a word he was saying, but he was speaking to us in his black robe. So I spent 10 years in residential school, and before going back into the forest to continue that. The only way of life that I knew as a youngster before I decided to go to law school. So I did my law school here, and I did start working with the Grand Council of the Cree for a long time, because my people struggled with a lot of developmental issues related to mining in the traditional Cree territory, related to forestry exploitation in the traditional Cree territory, and of course hydroelectric development. In those days, in the early 70s, the James Bay Project was one of the biggest hydroelectric developments in North America. And my people fought against that project because of the environmental impacts that it would have in our territory, because of the social impacts that the project would have on our territory, and we still can feel those social impacts in the James Bay territory. We notice it in our kids, in our children, our youth, and even on our way of life. So we knew that it would have enormous impacts. And over the last 45 years in the James Bay territory, we had all these different impacts from different developments happening in the territory, to a point that if you add all of the impacts of climate change in the Cree territory, well, it has cumulative impacts throughout the territory, which are pretty hard to assess at this point in time. But our elders and the people that live off the land of hunting, fishing, trapping, the Cree way of life, they see them. And they've seen them for the last 20 years. And they can talk about them. So there's a lot of knowledge that's being developed because of that in the Cree territory. And I worked for 23 years on the development, the drafting, and negotiation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. That work was carried out by this group that the UN created back in 1982, called the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous Populations. I must say that a lot of the issues that we discussed at the UN during those years, a lot of them were pretty difficult. I'll give you a couple of examples. First of all, the working group was called a working group on indigenous populations because the UN system, international law, did not recognize indigenous peoples as peoples. It took a long time for us to get the member states that we were negotiating with in that process to recognize that indigenous peoples were peoples like all other peoples on this planet. So that took almost a decade to get recognized. And it was important for us because we had all of the same characteristics as any other peoples on this planet. And we maintained that position throughout for a long time because only peoples under international law have a right to self-determination. So that's why it was important for us to get that recognition as peoples. And you can guess that the next challenge after that recognition was to get the member states to recognize that indigenous peoples, like all other peoples, have a right to self-determination. So having that recognition of the right to self-determination took many years to negotiate, to get the member states to accept it. You know, they said, yeah, maybe you have a right to self-determination as peoples, but it's not the same as other peoples. So they wanted to qualify the right of self-determination of indigenous peoples in a way that it would dilute that right or making it less as other rights of self-determination. That in itself was a long battle as well to get that recognition of a right, that we have a right to self-determination. The other example that I would give, and if you read the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, you'll find the provisions of number 25, Article 25 and following, that relate to lands, territories, and resources. Now, I think you can guess very easily why those provisions were important, as much as for us as for member states, because of the interests that are involved in land, in our traditional lands, territories, and resources. So I think that those are the hardest parts of our negotiations throughout that time. Fortunately, in September 2007, the UN General Assembly adopted the UN Declaration with an overwhelming majority. 4 countries voted against. 11 countries ended up abstaining from voting yes or no. And that included Russia, who wanted to vote against the UN Declaration, but after all, decided to abstain. So I think it was an important process that lasted 23 years. So over the time since 2007 when it was adopted, certain countries took measures to make sure that the UN Declaration is implemented within their own countries, within their own constitutions. And this is exactly where I come in. And in 2011, I decided to run as a candidate for the NDP in this country and got elected in 2011 as a member of parliament of one of the largest ridings in this country. And because I wanted to test the system, I wanted to test the institution called the Parliament of Canada and see how far we can go as a member of parliament to make sure that the human rights of the first peoples of this country are respected and recognized once and for all. We have a recognition presently under the Constitution, under Section 35, of course, but it's in very general terms, I would say. It's a recognition and affirmation of Aboriginal and treaty rights. We have to go to courts to clarify which exactly Aboriginal rights are we talking about here. And over the years, you've seen that the Supreme Court of Canada has confirmed many of those rights. So I did have a first private member's bill that I introduced back in 2011 to make sure that the laws of Canada and the laws of the Parliament of Canada are in harmony with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The first bill that I introduced in the previous parliament, back in 2011, was defeated by 17 votes in the final year of the previous parliament under the premiership of Stephen Harper. Stephen Harper, conservative government, had the majority in the House, and the conservatives voted in bloc against my bill, so it was defeated by 17 votes. So, but everybody knew that I was going to come back with it and reintroduce my private member's bill. It's a new one. It takes into consideration the recent developments in this country with respect to not only the UN Declaration, but the whole concept of reconciliation. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in their report that was tabled not too long ago, has 94 calls to action. The fundamental ones in those among those 94 are Call to Action 43 and Call to Action 44. And both of them, there are others where there is mention of the UN Declaration, but those two are supposed to be, according to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the framework for reconciliation in this country. So Call to Action 43 says, calls on the governments of Canada, provinces, territories, and municipalities to fully adopt and implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as the framework for reconciliation in this country. So no government among those mentioned in that call to action can say, we agree with all the calls to action, all 94 of them, but we have a slight problem with 43 because of that wording, adoption and implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, because it's the fundamental one, it's the framework for reconciliation, according to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And 44 talks about developing a national action plan for the implementation of the UN Declaration in collaboration and cooperation with Indigenous peoples for those governments. So two important calls to action. If you recall as well, during the last federal campaign, the federal government has talked about this new federal government, the Liberal Party, talked about implementing all 94 calls to actions, talked about implementing the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as well. The Minister of Aboriginal Affairs and the Minister of Justice of Canada also went to the UN, to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in May, and talked about adopting and implementing the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples at the UN most recently. My bill proposes to implement calls to action 43 and 44 of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and to deliver on those promises made by the new Liberal federal government to adopt and implement the UN Declaration. So one has to wonder, and it seems odd to me, one has to wonder why the federal government has not been responding to my direct question whether or not they support my private member's bill, C-262. They haven't committed to support my private member's bill, although my bill proposes to do exactly what they're saying and what they're promising. Kind of strange, right? Well, Tom talked about business as usual in his opening remarks. I think that's where we're at right now. So what I've been doing since I introduced the bill, I traveled throughout the country. I'm touring the country to talk about my bill and to not only Indigenous groups, but non-Indigenous groups, because reconciliation is about all of us. Reconciliation addresses both us and all of you. So I talked to indigenous and non-indigenous groups throughout the country. And Leah talked about a petition that I also carry around to call on the government of Canada to adopt and implement the UN Declaration. I think there's a distinction. there's a distinction between adopting and implementing. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission uses both words. It calls on the governments to fully adopt and implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. You implement through policies and programs that any government can change through time, but you adopt through legislation. And I'm providing this legislative framework for all of us for reconciliation.
That was MP Romeo Saganash, NDP critic for Intergovernmental Indigenous Affairs, who's tabled a private member's bill to ensure that the laws of Canada respect the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. You've been listening to excerpts from a panel at the World Social Forum called Indigenous People's Struggles and Resistance, Building Solidarity for Land, Self-Determination, and Justice. The World Social Forum was held in Montreal in early August of 2016. I'm Victoria Fenner. You've been listening to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a production of Rabble.ca. Thanks for listening.